Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. My name is Alex Slender, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. I also post links at kirksvilletoday.com and our social media medium, pieville.net. Today we're going to resume with George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power and do Chapter 7, which is not all that long of a chapter. 6 was quite long, about 20, closer to 20 pages. This is more like about 12 pages, maybe. Begins on PDF from Junior Books Online at 109. That's special number. Not as special as 110, though. It's going to be. Speaking of which, White Power, Chapter 7, is titled Friends of the Captain. Now, last time we took a closer look at Jews in chapter 6, and we heard the story of Joseph from the Bible, and we saw the pattern set through all Jew history, dating back, he alternately says, 3 to 4,000 years, long before Jesus. So Jews have nothing to do with Jesus, except they created him. But their behavior is what matters. Their traits are what matters. Their characteristics, and they hide under these different skins. The greatest lie about Jews is they pretend to be religion when they're actually a race. And they like whack-a-mole, they go from race to religion to nationality, and then under their individual names, they switch them for the names of the nation they currently are located in. But back to our overall extended metaphor analogy of shipwrecking crew. So, friends of the captain, giving people the wrong navigational charts, et cetera, et cetera. So last time we took a very close look at Jews and communism and Jews in the Bible and how Jews live off other people as people live off the land. So people are the land that Jews live off. They don't want to do the work. They want to be parasites, and they have created a culture and an inbred paranoid type that takes advantage of it. And they're always having to be afraid they're going to be found out and forced to move along, as it always happened in the past. A tapeworm is what he called them. So he's using different analogies, different metaphors. Back to the original metaphor that overarches the whole book, Friends of the Captain. Page 109 again. The Shipwrecking Plan, Chapter 7, Friends of the Captain. This shipwrecking plan is not the only one the Jews have in operation to get wealth without work. The aim is always the same, the capture of all the wealth and good of the world without working, and the enslavement of non-Jews to the glory and pleasure of the chosen ones, according to their own prophecies. While the brutal Bolshevik Jews wait on the shore to pounce on the ship as soon as it is finally wrecked, because they set up a false lighthouse, murder all hands, and walk off with the wealth, there is another gang of Jews already aboard ship with a different plan for taking over the wealth. This gang of Jews are the friends of the captain. They are not cutthroats or pirates, no sir. The friends of the captain, again, title of the chapter, are all pro-ship and anti-pirate. They are called capitalists. What their Jewish brothers lurking on the shore wait to do by force and violence, the captain's friends, in quotes, are already doing aboard ship by stealth and fraud as esteemed members of the ship's company. The ship is your nation, your white nation. These gentlemen Jews operate in striped pants and top hats, but their business is old Jewish-fashioned usury. Few notice that the phrase capitalist was popularized by none other than that bloody old Jew, Marx, himself a shipwrecker, Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital. Until Marx told our kind of people they were capitalists in his Das Kapital, they never gave what they were doing economically such a formal name. But they did know what they believed in. It was not capitalism. capital was only a tool for our people in the process of production. Men like Henry Ford were not interested simply in getting money. Rather, they were trying to do something, in Ford's case, give all Americans an automobile via Ford's discovery of mass production. In his famous paying his workers $5 a day, which was huge at the time, and reasoning that, well, if the more money they have, the more they're going to be able to afford my cars. It all hangs together. And knowing that, you know, you can't, ultimately, there's no such thing as cheap labor. Right? And if you think you can get away with doing slaves or underpaying people, eventually it's going to bite you in the ass. The American economy does not produce miracles because it is capitalist, but because it is enterprising and productive. The correct name of our system is not capitalism, but productive enterprise. Productive enterprise needs capital to invest in plants, etc. But it also needs labor, material, management, and 100 other things. Capital is only one of the tools of a productive enterprise system. It took the Jewish parasitic genius of Karl Marx to elevate that one tool, capital, to the status in our civilization by attacking it and calling it capitalism. He has thus trapped us into defending what he created, and is thereby, he's imposed his frame on us, they would say today, or his narrative, and has thereby doomed us to defeat because we defend a system based not on production, but on money manipulation. And this would be the founding of the Fed, which is just one specific central bank. The Fed is in the category of central bank. Wherever you find a central bank that has control of the money production, they can steal from the people by printing money. That's the basic technical tool by which Jews are able to steal your and my earnings and our wealth all away from us and turn us into slaves. And Bitcoin is the only known way to get around that right now. Capitalism is the naked worship of money, not as a tool, but as an idol. Capitalism is promoted by both sides in the crazy capitalism versus communism sham fight going on, again, parallel to Republican, Democrat, and 100 other things, fake fights, capitalism is taken to mean the making of money through the use of capital, not necessarily by working or producing. This would be financial investment or speculation, or simply manipulation of the stock market. In fact, most international capital is made not by working or producing or even taking any genuine risks, that's one big difference, but by manipulations of vast pools of money with inside information from Jews in high positions. This is one way that a lot of the top congressmen get rich, like Pelosi. A perfect sample of the way Jews operate to get money as capitalists, without working, without producing anything, and without taking any genuine risks, is the way the Jewish Rothschild fortune was founded. As is usual with international Jews, one branch of the Rothschild family got entrenched in the money system in England, while another branch set up business in France, and the pair, the father of them all, came up from Frankfurt, Germany. And he sent his sons out across Europe. Just before the Battle of Waterloo, in which Napoleon faced possible defeat for the first time, the two gangs of Jews operating the two enemy countries were actually working together. The French Rothschild set up a series of semaphore stations. Those are the colored flags that on a ship that signal. The French Rothschild set up a series of semaphore stations through France and across the channel to England, by which they could flash news of which way the battle went to their Jewish brothers in supposedly enemy England. So borders mean nothing to a Jew, because they are their own nation. The waiting Jew Rothschilds in Britain thus received word of the outcome of the historic battle hours before anyone else in England. Note that the Jewish enterprise in setting up the communications network was not shared with either Britain or France, but was secret, for the sole benefit of Jews on both sides. Knowing in advance of anyone in England the outcome of the battle which decided forever the fates of France and Napoleon and the fate of England, the English Rothschilds, waiting in the London Stock Exchange, speculated in huge sums, knowing full well the outcome of the battle, while the trusting British Gentiles were still waiting for the news. The suckers never had a chance. The Rothschilds got their hands on millions and millions in moments, without work and without risk. The same racket is known as past posting in the horse racing business. Well, this is old. It wouldn't be possible now, but it was possible back then when they had to relay the results by a slightly slower method. There was at least a little bit of a gap before the horse race result could become known. Today, there's no gap like that. But in the 60s, and remember, he's writing and publishing this in the last year of his life in 1967. The same racket as what the Rothschilds did with Napoleon and Waterloo is known as past posting in the horse racing business, where the results of the race are tape recorded, held back, and then rebroadcast after the race so that unsuspecting bookies can be euchred into paying off. That just means hookered or snookered or hooked, tricked, rooked, into paying off bets which are actually sure things. After the race, if you pass post, you go to jail as a criminal. But if you are Jewish and do it in a big way, swindling millions of people out of millions of dollars, you become an international banker and a great advisor to presidents. Bernard Baruch, the famous Jewish advisor to presidents, made millions and millions in the U.S. stock market while hundreds of Gentile businessmen were leaping out of windows to their deaths, ruined in the Great Depression of 1929. So notice within 15 years of setting up the central bank, the Federal Reserve, so-called, there's a Great Depression. Advance information helps. To see clearly the nature of our present economy and for whose benefit it has been set up, take a look at the tax structure. For instance, suppose you work in poverty the next 5 years to invent a new machine by which blind people can see. Surely this would be a magnificent boon to society. You set up a little factory to produce these machines and work hard day and night to make them available to blind people. At the end of the year, let us say you have earned $1 million. Uncle Sam will come and take at least 70% of that money you earned, maybe as much as 90%. The rate of taxation on the money people earn by working and producing can go over 90%. But now, let us suppose instead of inventing and building something to benefit society, you are a rich Jew and you have a friend in the White House, a not unlikely combination. Your White House friend lets you know that the USA is going to place a multi-million dollar contract for a new rocket with a specific company. You pick up a telephone and order your broker to transfer ownership of $1 million worth of other stock holdings to the new company. That's all you do. A year later, your stock in that company has doubled, and you now have $2 million, although you have done nothing, risked nothing, and produced nothing. Paper manipulation, so-called investing, but it's really speculation in name, but not reality. In reality, it's sure-thinging due to your inside connections and information. But now, see what the government does about your taxes in this case. Such a gain, stocks held over 6 months, is called a capital gain and taxed a maximum of only 25%. With a sharp Jewish lawyer, special trusts, and other manipulations, you can cut this tax down to less than 5 or 6%. This outrageous system puts a premium on speculation or gambling and an enormous drag on production, management savings, risk, invention, and plain old work. The difference between a Jew economy and an Aryan economy. Those who produce, save, risk, manage, work, and invest pay millions every year to produce an easy life for the Jewish leeches who never provide a bit of management, risk, invention, or honest work to our economy and pay the least taxes. How long do you think an economy can remain healthy and productive when the intelligent men begin to see that working is for suckers, when an easy life can be had by manipulation? And that's precisely what has happened to America and the West ever since the Jewish Sharpies have forced honest Gentiles to play the same dirty game or remain poor suckers. Fewer and fewer people are willing to work anymore as more and more people discover there are easier Jewish ways to make a living. But there comes a time when fruits rot off vines because nobody will work picking them, when buildings fall apart because nobody will work taking care of them, when jobs by the thousands go begging, even while vast numbers of people, especially Negroes, are moaning about unemployment. Work, one of the healthiest and most character-building activities of humanity, becomes degraded and abandoned in any economy where Jews establish capitalist speculation as the goal of all but the dumbest. The dumbest aren't smart enough to speculate, and they get ripped off because their wages are ripped off through inflation. To go back to our ship of state analogy, the capitalist Jewish friends of the captain do nothing more than shift the cargo around back and forth between different groups, always taking a big hunk out. There is never more cargo as a result of their operations, always less for producers, while Jews get richer. This operation they call international banking. The little guys who get in the stock market are told they share the ownership of the big corporations. But the little guys in the stock market are exactly what the people around the roulette table are to the house. The Jews and a few choice friends are the house in the stock market. They have inside information from other Jews in the White House and government bureaus as to the location of new freeways, purchase of land for government projects, vast oil and armament purchases, wars, fair trade prosecutions, antitrust prosecutions, etc. Such speculation is not gambling any more than the house gambles. The little guys are sweet-talked in to provide the money gathered up by the big guys. It's not hard to see how the Jews can swindle the little guys with this racket. They keep the little man too busy and brainwashed to see or even think about what's going on. But more amazing, the Jews have managed to get our biggest and richest men convinced that they too are capitalists. The Jews have become partners with such as the Rockefellers, Carnegies, Fords, Johnsons, etc. in this gigantic past-posting racket, with the result that production and enterprise have been forgotten more and more in the ugly scramble over capital and money, regardless of production. That's why products become ever more shoddy and cheap, even as prices go whizzing up. That's why the big billionaire foundations are to be found always on the side of Jewish leftist projects, and it's why the character is disappearing out of the old American family fortunes. Henry Ford would leap out of his grave and slaughter his own grandchildren and great-grandchildren if he could see and know what they have done with the billions he made by producing and what they have become as pro-Jewish capitalists. Say nothing of the Ford Foundation, soon captured and turned exactly against what he would have wanted. There's nothing immoral or wrong about a man investing his capital in a genuine productive enterprise which benefits the people with either a valuable goods or services. If he can make money doing this, then so much the better. Others will try to do still better by competition, and the goods and services therefore offered to the people get better and better. That's the free, productive economic process which created the American economic miracle. But that's not what the Jews and their capitalist friends do. Remember the way the Rothschilds made millions at the Battle of Waterloo? What did they give the British or the French people for all they took? Can you think of one single benefit they delivered? Their operation was all clever take and no give. Further, it was based on fratricidal bloodshed, on Aryan white men of France slaughtering Aryan white men of England for relatively minor reasons, while the fanatically united Hebrews made cash out of the mutual murder. In every war except World War II, which was for the survival of Jewry, these same Jews have taken both sides, sold both sides the guns and uniforms and flags to wave at each other. In the Civil War, for instance, the British Rothschilds backed the South, while the French Rothschilds backed the North. These, quote, capitalist Jews can usually be found in the ranks of what they call Zionists, the Jews who wear the beanies, the Jews who pose in the garb of the Jewish religion, and who insist on fulfilling their paranoiac prophecies of world ownership and domination as God's chosen people. They believe they will own the world and enslave all the rest of us when they have all of Jerusalem, and they lack only a few blocks now. This holy pose of theirs works only so long as nobody actually checks this Jewish religion, which is actually a code of operations for the chosen ones to swindle, ruin, and enslave the rest of us, as we have shown. The secret of the Jewish capitalist, Zionist side of the parasitic operation for gaining the wealth of the Gentiles is make-believe. The only reality in economics is goods and services, property and productive labor. All the talk of money, currency, inflation, deflation is a smokescreen. He who has a monopoly of goods and services has the wealth. Money is only a sort of ticket to these goods and services. The Jews actually invented the basic principles of capitalist stealing by money manipulations long before Christ in ancient Babylon. Originally, the ancients used actual chunks of gold or precious metals and stones for their medium of exchange. The Babylonians became tremendously wealthy, however, and soon found that trying to lug around bone-crushing weights of the precious but heavy gold in trading operations. The clever Jews stepped in and volunteered to be keepers of the heavy gold for wealthy merchants and do the lugging whenever necessary. The Jew keepers of the gold issued the Babylonian merchants little stone tokens with carved indications of the value of gold deposited as receipts, obviously from there to paper money. From real money as the bullion to representational money to money unbacked by anything, pure fiat. That's the history of money. It wasn't long before merchants discovered that they could actually trade with each other using the stone receipts from the Jews instead of actual gold. And the Jews in turn discovered that as soon as the merchants got used to the idea of trading not with actual gold, but with the stone receipts, the merchants gradually stopped taking gold in and out of the vaults maintained by the Jews. Merchants began to use the receipts as gold, and the gold itself never moved from the vault, no matter how many times it changed ownership. Thus was born money, and with it, the biggest swindle in the history of humanity, a swindle still going on. Which would be fiat or fractional reserve. Note that the Jews did not have to produce the gold every time there was a transaction. It was always there, and the merchants soon stopped checking it. On those rare occasions it was called for, the Jews always delivered. But the Jews discovered that they could always deliver any gold that might be called for, even if they didn't have enough gold to cover all the receipts they had issued. In fact, they found out that they were perfectly safe with no more than 10% of the gold for which they had issued receipts. In other words, they could issue 10 times the amount of receipts for gold as they had gold to deliver. And that's precisely what the early Jews did and how they became capitalists. That is fractional reserve banking. Same principle. For every pound of gold delivered to his keeping, the Jew gained 9 pounds of gold value simply by issuing to himself 9 more receipts on the same 1 pound of gold, then using these unbacked receipts to trade with merchants for what he wanted and for power in the state. Believe it or not, that is precisely exactly what he and his Gentile partners are doing to you today, right here in America. The Federal Reserve, set up by the Jew Paul Warburg of the House of Rothschild, has the power to do precisely what the early Jews in Babylon did, issue receipts, called money or currency, for what is supposed to be on deposit in their vaults, but it isn't. The Constitution of the United States expressly forbids this because the founding fathers were well aware of this centuries-old swindle of fractional reserve banking through a central bank. Only Congress has the power to coin money. Yet now the Federal Reserve coins are money. Under Jewish pressure, our Congress, the creature from Jekyll Island is a book you want to read to learn all how the true history of this in the United States. Creature from Jekyll Island by Griffin. Under Jewish pressure, our Congress in 1913 passed the unlawful Federal Reserve Act, creating a central bank, which has gone into the old robbing act of the Babylonian Jews with a will and style never seen before in history. The Federal Reserve, a semi-private organization, coins your money at will, swipes the actual assets and property, and shows a profit while you, as a U.S. citizen, stagger under a national debt to these international bankers so huge it is beyond the conception of the human mind. And this from 1967, before it truly took off, the debt. And the way they have pulled it off, the way they have pulled off this atrocious robbery of the American people is the same way the ancient Babylonian Jews swindled the merchants of that time. By issuing nine times as many tokens for the gold deposits they held, the Jews got, quote, tickets to enjoy the wealth and production of the Gentile Babylonians without working and without getting caught legally. By setting up the Federal Reserve and passing an unconstitutional law to let them issue 10 times as much paper and debt as they hold in assets, the Federal Reserve and those who rake in the profit and the interest on the astronomical debt reap gigantic rewards without working. Our people have been conned into lumping our own honest system of productive enterprise with the dishonest, rotten swindle of Jewish usury dressed up as capitalism, and then being forced to defend the immoral and rotten result. Thus, the Jews have us worshiping their own thievery because we are told, and we believe, we are capitalists. Whenever the Jews can get things so complicated and removed from the basic realities of goods and services that the tickets to these things, money, become something of value itself in the eyes of the population, the Jews can really move in and operate. The national debt, now about 300 times what it was in 1910, $1.1 billion, is now $336 billion. Guess how much it is today? It's in the trillions. I think it's, what is it, over $30 trillion. So that's what's gone from 1910, it was $1.1 billion. 1967, it was $336 billion. And now it's like $31, $32 trillion, not counting unfunded liabilities, which are another $90 trillion on top of that, I believe. Interest alone amounts to $14 billion a year. Well, that's nothing today. That's probably what we owe in one day, practically. The per capita debt is now about $1,700. Ha, it's in the hundreds of thousands now. Actually, it's probably over $1 million now. When the Federal Reserve took charge, the per capita debt was $12. Since 1960, the cost of living has risen 10.5%. The dollar is now worth only 45 cents compared to the 1941 dollar. What now cost $2.22 would have cost $1.25. Of course, it's gone down to like lost 99% of its value at the point in 2023 when I'm talking. The deficit for the first 8 months of fiscal 1967 was $17.181 billion. U.S. gold is now down to a 30-year low of about $13.1 billion, a loss of more than $11 billion in 10 years. And in 67, you could still turn in your notes for gold, so it still had a little bit of true value. But Nixon put an end to that in 1973, closing the gold window, and then it became pure fiat with zero backing, zero restraint on how it could be printed and spent, allowing for the metastasizing of the warfare welfare state. And both those wars directed against whites. Only $2.8 billion is now available to meet foreign claims. The dollars held by foreigners keep rising and are now up to $27 billion. Later this year, Congress will end the requirement that a reserve of 25% in gold be maintained against Federal Reserve notes, the nation's paper money. They get the people worshiping what they call capitalism, make it almost a religion, set up money as the idol, and then proceed to get all the money by their devilish, clever manipulations. And once they have possession of the people's idol money, they also have the power. People today are slaves of money and therefore slaves of the Jews. Nobody dares oppose or criticize these Jews because of the terrible power of their purse. If you dare criticize or attack a Jew, then you and your family must starve, for you will find all avenues for the normal procurement of the money you need to survive slammed shut. So see, they were deplatforming and financially attacking anyone who criticized them long before the internet ever existed. Perhaps even more deadly and more insidious is the way the Jews promptly use the vast pools of money they gather in by capitalistic manipulations to buy the minds of their victims. So he's very much channeling. This is where, you know, Pierce, he's taken from Hitler and Pierce is taken from Rockwell. These are all connected and they're all saying the same thing because it's true. You can only think about what you know. Thus, what you think about is the product of what you hear and see, what you read in the papers, see on TV, hear on the radio, learn in school, see in movies, etc. If somebody were to gain complete control of all the ways you gather your information, letting you hear and see only what they wanted, and keeping other facts from you, they would control your mind and thus control you. This is exactly what the chart-forging Jews have done. Take just one of the many methods by which you gain what you hope for are the facts all around you. TV. TV is, without any doubt, again, before cable here, there's only three networks, the most powerful medium in the world. A speech by the president, for instance, or Huntley Brinkley, reaches more people in half an hour than could be reached by all the pamphleteers since Thomas Paine. This is the era of mass communications, and he who controls TV controls the minds of Americans. You have only three networks, CBS, ABC, and NBC. President of NBC is Robert Sarnoff, a Russian Jew. The chairman of the board of CBS is William Paley, or Polinsky, a Russian Jew. The president of ABC is Leonard Goldenson, a Russian Jew. Whenever you see and hear on TV, whatever you see and hear on TV is fed to you by one of these three Russian Jews. Paley, Polinsky, Goldenson, Sarnoff. And so you never see a Negro criminal on a TV crime show, for instance, although 85% of all serious crime, by FBI stats, is committed by Negroes. You especially never see a Jewish criminal, even when it's an integral part of the story, as in Oliver Twist, Fagin, Dickens. On the other hand, in one TV show after the other, whenever there is some rotten, depraved character in a scene, 9 times out of 10 they make him an ignorant, foul-mouthed, tobacco-chewing, scraggly-bearded, cruel, southern, white, Protestant, Anglo-Saxon of the lowest and vilest sort. Just observe how many times a villain in a TV show will have a southern or a German accent. Simultaneously with the Jewish capitalist Zionist takeover of TV, they have been buying up newspapers and magazines faster and faster. In New York, the Jewish Sulzbergers own the New York Times, the Jewish Schiffs, the New York Post, and all but one of the other papers. Samuel Newhouse owns the New Orleans Times-Picayune and is the publisher of the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger, with Philip Hochstein as editor and Sam Israel among directors. Walter H. Annenberg is the editor and publisher of the Philadelphia Inquirer and the president of Triangle Publications, Inc. Paul Block is the publisher of the Pittsburgh PA Post-Gazette, the Toledo Blade, and the Toledo Times. Philip L. Graham, the son-in-law of the late Eugene Meyer, is the owner of the Washington Post. John Cowles, Jr. is the editor of the only two dailies in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Tribune, in the Minneapolis Star. So all the big cities have papers that are owned almost exclusively by Jews. To digress a moment, I'd like to mention the tendency of American journalism toward monopolization. In 1890, Chicago had 11 newspapers. Today it is only 4, and now today it would only have like 1 or 2. Even in the biggest cities, it might only have 2. And the small, medium cities almost always only have 1. So this trend's been going on for 100 years, practically. In 1890, Chicago had 11 newspapers. 1890. Today it has only 4. The Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Daily News, the Chicago American, and the Sun-Times. Even in 1934, 82% of all the daily newspapers had a complete monopoly in their communities. And according to editor and publisher, 63 chains owned and operated 361 daily newspapers, which made 13% of the total. And these 361 newspapers controlled over 37% of the total daily circulation. In fact, 6 chains controlled 81 dailies with more than 9 million circulation, which meant over 21% of the country's total. It's the same with magazines. This is where Pierce gets his idea that who controls America, his famous pamphlet about media control. It's the same with magazines. Look, for instance, has the impact of a mind bomb on our people, as witnessed the recent hassle over the Kennedy story in Look. It is owned by the Jewish Cowles brothers. The Jewish Zimbalist family has recently taken over the old Benjamin Franklin Journal, the Saturday Evening Post. Even on the right side of things, it is again Jews in the lead. David Lawrence, president and editor of U.S. News and World Report, is Jewish, and so is the Meyer family of Newsweek. They're associated with the Washington Post. The publisher of The New Yorker is Raoul H. Fleischman. The chairman of Parents magazine is George J. Hecht. Book publishing has become ever more and more Jewish, from Simon & Schuster, Inc., through Alfred A. Knopf, Inc., all of them violently leftist. The theater business has been 100% Jewish ever since the Jews Lee Schubert and Abraham Erlanger and all other Broadway Hebrews. Does any American need to be reminded who owns and runs the movie business as a private monopoly? Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Warner Brothers, etc., etc. In fact, there is no field where the Jews are not seizing more and more control away from the white Christians who fought for and built America. It starts, again, with the Jewish power of money to get what they want, because they have so much more money than anyone else. They can buy all these. And they just get huge leverage from first their ethnic loyalty. That's the foundation on which the rest is built. And the two main pillars are media control and money comes even before media control. You can buy everything else once you got the money. Here's a clipping from the New York Times, October 4th, 1964, which reveals the staggering information that 80% of young Jews are going to college. And therefore, and remember, as late as the 20s, there was probably only about 10% of Americans who were going to college. So 80%, 30 years later, 80% of young Jews are going to college, and therefore will soon be hogging up most of the professional positions in America, while the Gentiles, who can't afford college in such numbers, will have to minister to the royal needs of these wealthy professional Jews. This is the same thing that happened in Germany and will lead to the same explosion of hatred against these Jews, no matter how it is covered up. Perhaps you will say that the Jews have a right to go to college, even all of them, if they can earn that right. Maybe so, I will agree that a man has a right to whatever he can earn. But as I have tried hard to prove with documents heretofore, many of the Jews gain their advantage legally but unfairly, by combination, conspiracy, sneaking advance information, rigged speculation, etc., not by honest work and production, as most non-Jews have to earn their money. Using his unfairly gained wealth, the Jews proceed to dominate their hosts and take over the nation, which generously permitted them to operate in its midst. And no nation on earth, except a nation of utter worms, will forever tolerate guests taking over their own home no matter how they do it. Only about 20% of young Gentiles at the very most attend college, while 80% of the Jews are going to the universities. Now that'd be 50% of college-age people go to college now. But again, there was a tremendous expansion of college after World War II and lowering of the college standards because only maybe 10, 15% at absolute most are capable of college material. So it had to be dumbed down. Became very profitable. There's loads of openings for new professors. And then all that died some point in the 70s. It started going the other way. And now it's extremely hard to get a teaching job. So, and yeah, these jobs are all filled by leftist ideologues, many, many, many of whom are Jews. Anyway, but his point stands that the areas are being aced out of their own country that they built. And this means in turn, 20% versus 80% going to college, that our professions will become more and more Jewish, while the non-college educated Gentiles will find themselves serving these clever Jews. How long do these Jews think that 150 million non-Jewish Americans will tolerate serving this arrogant 2% of the population, which boasts that it is sending almost all its young into our professions to be our lawyers, our doctors, our executives, and our politicians, and even our Christian ministers, as many of them are becoming, even priests? Incidentally, while Jews like Oesterreicher, Riker, and Scheel have become priests and even bishops in Irish Catholic communities, how many Irish rabbis do you know? Moving on to 119. I could go on almost endlessly on this subject, but let the doubting reader convince himself with his own observation by simply noticing the way everything in the way of information for the minds and hearts of America is or has been twisted farther and farther to the left and toward disgusting flattery of Jews and Negroes and less patriotism, and especially the elimination of any mention of the great works of the white race. In fact, the most shocking example of the way minds of Americans have been twisted by these Zionist capitalist Jews who have used their gold to buy control of minds is what they have done with the facts of race by the use of their money and their publishing power. Just 50 years ago, you would have been laughed at had you suggested it might be possible to eliminate from the minds of millions all the plain facts of the difference in human races. Every encyclopedia, every book, every professor, every farmer knew the facts, and the facts were and still are right before our eyes all over nature. But the Jews cannot afford to allow this knowledge to exist, lest their victims notice that a racial group of Jews, posing as a religion, is eating them alive and preparing a total racial attack on them to enslave or murder them. So they first got some clever Jewish professors into top university slots, such as Columbia University, although Columbia is by no means a unique example. They got these anthropology professors to begin teaching that there was no such thing as race, all the way back to Franz Boas, right? The McDonald covers. In spite of the madness of this and the total lack of evidence, the proponents of this insanity began to be touted in Jewish magazines, press, and books as the very Socrates and Platos of anthropology. The first and most important of these pioneer biological liars was a pro-communist Jew named Franz Boas, who regularly sent warm greetings to Comrade Stalin on his birthdays. Citing Jewish Voice, January 1942, Franz Boas sending greetings to Stalin, and whose red record cannot be denied by any objective observer. This communistic Jew began teaching anthropology at Columbia University in 1896 and dominated the anthropology department there until his death in 1942. Meanwhile, he produced one book after another proving, quote-unquote, that there were no such things as racial differences among men, citing, parentheses, Kultur und Rasse, Kultur and Rasse, Leipzig, 1914, Anthropology and Modern Life, New York, 1928, Aryans and Non-Aryans, New York, 1934, Race, Language, and Culture, New York, 1940. The whole of Jewry pitched in with fanatic will to boost their boy. Boaz was praised in every Jewish-owned newspaper and periodical and given every academic prize they could invent or promote. At the same time, the Jewish media blasted as bigots any critics who dared question their Jewish hero and his arrogant pronouncements against the facts of race. Little by little, the critics were intimidated and silenced, while the public began to see Boaz as little short of a god. This Jewish Mutual Admiration Society made Boaz the, quote, acknowledged authority, unquote, in social anthropology and ethnology. His students and colleagues at Columbia, Herskovitz, Kleinberg, Ashley Montague, Weltfish, all Jews, all pro-red, spread Boaz's anti-race lies far and wide, deliberately poisoning the minds of generations of students and professors at American universities and prostituting a great science. It is still going on now as you read this. So what does Jesus Christ need to add him to that list? And every bit of this miracle in reverse was done by the Jewish power of gold. Gold promoted out of the hands of our people by old-fashioned Jewish usury and manipulation, dressed up in the striped pants and top hat of capitalism. With their bought and paid for press, TV, etc., the Jews can reward pro-Jewish toadies, and they can brutally punish with smears those who dare to attack them or even just tell the truth. A man of high position, if he attacks the Jews, is subjected to the most vicious and brutal kind of national smears and personal attacks in all the organs of public opinion. Even if he doesn't attack the Jews directly, but only attacks Jewish communism without mentioning Jews, like McCarthy or Robert Welch or the New American, you know, the Birchers, the Jews still go after him with all the stops pulled out. Even if you leave, don't name the Jew, they'll still attack you if you're attacking their project or threatening it or bringing it into infamy. To fathom the real depth of the villainy of the Zionist Friends of the Captain, one must see what they have done to the productive economy of the white man in perspective, at a long view. The white man everywhere sets up a productive economy in which everybody works, manages, or takes genuine risks in an enterprise in which he has a personal interest. The economy of the Aryan is always productive enterprise, regardless of the fancy names that may be applied to various forms of the operation. Each man gives to the society at least as much as he takes out. The economy of the Jew is parasitic. He always takes out more than he puts in. As soon as the Jew got enough strength in our society, he began to twist and pervert this productive enterprise into a criminal operation forbidden by law almost everywhere for centuries. Usury. He began to blind our kind of people to the immorality of getting without producing or giving in return. He began to de-emphasize the production aspect of the work and management of Aryan economy and emphasize the getting of money by any and all possible means, short of robbery. He removed the focus of Aryan eyes from the product to the profit. Craftsmanship and pride of product began to disappear as the desperate scramble to get money replaced the time-honored Aryan joy in creation of things and excellence and performance. Turn out more shoddy products, shine them up to look good on the outside, sell them for as high a price as possible, and then forget it once the money is in the pocket. That was the new approach of the Jew, which has filled America with billions of tons of plastic, shoddy junk. The next step was to de-emphasize all production, so you go from craft to junk to nothing, and concentrate on manipulation of money and credit to gather in still more money, without work, without management, invention or creation, and without any real risk. Usually the Jew had tribesmen in the councils of the mighty, whence he got the information that enabled him to, quote, speculate and reap vast harvests of green cash with no risk. The Jew has no skin in the game except your white skin. Whether it's a war, bloody red war, physical war or whether it's green war, money. This harvest of cash without returning to society value for money received is immoral and destructive, and no society can survive it forever. The Jew Karl Marx then slyly attacked this immoral process, identified it as the same thing as Aryan free enterprise, cleverly called both the enterprise and the usury capitalism, and thus got all our people defending Jewish usury as, quote, our sacred way of life, capitalism, kind of like the way the Jew perverted the concept of free speech by turning it into pornography and turning real speech, real valid protected speech, as hate speech. The Jew took productive enterprise, relabeled it capitalism, to mix it with his own usury, his own central bank swindling, his fiat, his fractional reserve swindling. Pushing the process harder and harder, the Jews managed to split the inventors, owners, and managers from their own workers in the once productive economy and produce class warfare between the two parts of our economy, while the Jew manipulates both segments to reap more and more cash, all without working or producing. This, in turn, forces more and more of our management people to get down in the gutter with the Jews and compete at the same immoral, cutthroat economic piracy in order to survive. The Aryan, too, becomes a capitalist. Now the Jew, friend of the captain, fans the fires of destruction ever higher by having the other side of Jewry, the communist friends of the crew, so the capitalist friends of the captain and the communist friends of the crew, you got them in a pincer, right? Leap more and more vicious attacks on the rich capitalists by the workers. And to lead it to the last, next chapter to close this one, let's take a look at these Jewish friends of the crew. So he just went through how the Jews manipulate money and capitalism, what they do to an economy, how they obtain parasitically undeserved wealth from non-productive manipulation and other forms of cheating and swindling and lying and stealing. And then they buy up all the media and it becomes hard even to tell what's going on. That's what Jews do on the capitalist side. And that was the subject of this chapter 7 of George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power. And it draws to an end right there. So thanks for being with me today. And I'll be back with you again real, real soon for more from George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power. And as always, permanently archived at vnnforum.com.